From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Do you believe in magic? Well, a lot of people in America do.
I talk to people who think of themselves as werewolves. I talk to people who think of themselves as elves and dragons.
And let's not forget your ordinary, everyday witches and wizards, too.
If you passed a wizard in the street, I think you would know it. They wouldn't necessarily be wearing some elaborate costume, but the aura of energy and power that would emanate from them, I think you would recognize.
In this hour, what happens when magic comes off the big screen and walks the streets? When witches roam supermarket aisles and wizards wear business suits and ride mass transit? Is it all just make-believe and Halloween hijinks? Or could there possibly be something here that's real?
Magic is not waving a Harry Potter wand and making demons appear. It's really very, very simple things. My favorite definition for magic is the art of changing consciousness at will.
We're all doing a kind of magic all the time, but we only think it's magic because we haven't broadened our mind enough to think that it should be common.
So, as Harry Potter might put it, which are you? Muggle or magician? Stay with us, and you may discover that the most magical thing of all is yourself. It's one thing to like stories and movies about wizards and elves, or play video games in which you can be an elf or wizard, or even to dress up as one every now and then. It's another thing entirely to think you really are one.
The Silver Elves are a couple, in California, of course, who have been elves since the mid-70s. Now, they think of being elves as a sort of personality or spiritual type, but they're so serious about it that the husband, whose name is Zardoa, has put together a 35,000-word elven language. Well, we were sitting in their living room on the floor because that's where they sit. And he was in the kitchen making hot tea, and he misunderstood me, and I heard him yell, "Weird? Of course it's weird. What's weirder than thinking you're an elf?"
It's Christine Wicker talking with Anne Strangechamps. Christine's a journalist, a religion reporter. Last year, she wrote a book called Lilydale, the story of a town in New York famous for its mediums. For her next book, she's been investigating magical belief in America, and she's found it everywhere.
Well, my first stop was Salem, which you might know has been reclaimed by the witches and the Wiccans. And I went there thinking, well, this is the biggest magical group, which is astonishing to me how long they've been around and how they continue to grow. But while I was there, they started talking to me about something they call the magical community. And that caused me to realize that there was a lot more going on out there than I knew. Some of it's folk magic. Some of it is very ancient high magic that's going on. And so I began to pursue that. And the other thing that convinced me that there was a lot of magic is the minute that I started doing this, because I began to poke into Santeria, into voodoo, into hoodoo, which is an African-American magical system, people would say to me almost invariably, "I wouldn't do that if I was you." They would say, "Aren't you scared?" And I would say, "No, I don't believe in it." And then they would go, "Yeah, right, I don't either." And I knew then, of course, that they did, because then they would say, "Well, no, I don't believe in it, but I wouldn't mess with that stuff." So I then began to sort of feel sorry for all of us, because I realized that most of us don't believe in good magic anymore, but we still believe in bad magic. It's still going to get us.
What was the most bizarre thing you saw or community you visited when you were on the road researching magic?
Boy, most bizarre. That would be a tall order for this book. I talk to people who think of themselves as vampires, the kind that live off of energy sometimes, and also the kind that like a taste or two of blood. I talk to people who think of themselves as werewolves. I talk to people who think of themselves as elves and dragons.
These people are serious. Wait. People are serious? They really think they're vampires?
Well, some of them think that it's a sort of personality type or spiritual type. Others think that they really, really are.
What do today's vampires do?
Well, they work at night if they can. Most of them now are energy vampires, although some are still sanguine vampires or blood vampires too. They have jobs generally, and they study. And one interesting thing is they have a code of ethics now.
And, so what, you have to ask first?
Yes. Yes, because it's not nice to steal someone's energy without their permission. But the thing that was wonderful about this was that I began to realize, to my great surprise, as I looked into the dark side of magic, how strong the good is. What a really powerful draw it has for people, because the vampires are now talking quite a bit about how they can give back to society.
What are they wanting to give back?
Well, they believe that their taking energy from people can help people recycle their energy and be more energetic themselves. They think that they can remember past lives and that they have some kinds of wisdom to pass on.
Where did you find these modern-day vampires?
Well, they are all over the internet, and they're all over this country. It's very easy to find them. I was just astonished at how many there are. This particular house of vampires, it was in a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio.
Did the people you talked with, the magical believers, did any of them practice any magic around you? Did you see any?
I participated in some things and even tried some magic out myself. You know, it's a lot about perception. And I didn't see anything that I saw personally that just blew me away. I did hear some wonderful stories.
How about just personally? Did you experience anything that changed you?
You know, I don't think I'll ever look at the world in quite the same way again. There's just this sense of possibility that magical people have always had through the centuries, a sense that you can reach God, that you can reach spirits, and that human beings are powerful in ways that they don't always understand.
Christine Wicker talking with Anne Strangehamps. Christine's book, Lilydale, The True Story of the Town That Talks to the Dead, is just out in paper. And her book on American magic will be out next year, in time for Halloween. What is magic, anyway? Make-believe? Or something we can all do?
Did you ever make anything happen? Anything you couldn't explain when you were angry or scared? You're a wizard, Harry.
Coming up, what is magic? But first, acclaimed Celtic historian John Matthews says belief in magic never disappeared. It just went into the movies.
I don't think it's ever really gone away. I think, like everything else, you know, there's always a swing of the pendulum, and sometimes some things are not so popular. Right now, it does seem as though magic and wizards are just about the most popular thing around.
John Matthews was the historical consultant on the recent King Arthur movie. He's written more than 40 books on the Arthurian legends and the Western mystery tradition. Steve Paulson asked him to talk a bit about the deeper significance of wizards. What do they have to tell us about our secret longings and hidden beliefs? And why are they so popular today?
I don't know why exactly, but I suspect it may have something to do with the fact that in our hearts, maybe we'd all like to be wizards. We'd like to be able to do magic.
Just because it's fun, or because there's something more going on there?
Well, certainly because it's fun, but also because I think, you know, we'd like the idea, I think, of being able to do magic, of being perhaps more in control of the elements and of life around us, you know, not quite so much at the mercy of the tides of fate and time.
I don't expect many of you to appreciate the subtle science and exact art that is potion making. However, for those select few, I can teach you how to bewitch the mind and ensnare the senses. I can tell you how to bottle fame, brew glory, and even put a stopper in death.
Let me ask you about the wizards we see on screen. Should we read more into them than just being kind of interesting literary figures?
I think that, you know, if you go deeply behind all of this, you've got the idea that someone who has access to this kind of power, and I don't think it's an unnatural power. I don't think it's something that is necessarily, you know, fantasy. I think it's a power that is actually all around us. It's the power that's in the natural world. And what wizards seem to be able to do is to harness that in some way to themselves. So, of course, it enables them to do things that appear to us to be extraordinary.
Could I have your attention, please? Now, today we will be transforming animals into water goblets. One, two, three. Ferraverto.
Well, it also seems to me that there's a fundamentally different way of thinking about the world. I mean, just the whole notion that you can shapeshift suggests that there's something kind of illusory about surface reality.
Oh, yes. I mean, we're brought up now almost from the cradle to believe that all there really is what we can, you know, sense with our four senses. What we can't see, touch, hear, or smell doesn't exist. Which I think is a tragedy, because we're losing, gradually beginning to lose a sense of the wonder of the world around us and the fact that there is more than just the surface. I mean, everyone who I've ever talked to, and I've talked to a lot of people and worked with a lot of people who are practicing shamans or who are practicing magicians even in the modern sense, all of them talk about the way that they feel that they are touching into something very deep, just below the surface, just beyond our immediate everyday awareness. And this is what I feel we're losing in a way by just being, in a way, told that there is only this and nothing more.
There's no such thing as magic.
You're talking about wizards as though they're real people. I know you were the historical consultant on the new King Arthur movie. Is that what you found? Was Merlin a real person?
What I found in the researches I did for the book I've just written about him was that there is a character called Merthyn who dates, in fact, from a little bit after the period of King Arthur, who was a poet, who was a prophet and a seer. And he seems to have been a Welsh prince, in fact, who fought a great battle, an actual historical battle, which took place in the 7th century. And he went mad as a result of seeing the carnage, of seeing close friends and relatives killed in battle. And he went into the woods and became a wild man and lived in the woods. And when he came out of there, which he did eventually, he was eventually healed, he had this extraordinary new ability. He had the ability to prophesy events that were to come.
But you're also suggesting that he had to go through that darkness, that very difficult time, to become a true wizard, to really come into his own.
Yes, this is something that goes all the way through all of the traditions of the wizard and the shaman. I mean, if you go back again to these very early figures, the shamans, they usually had to undergo some form of illness, some kind of life-threatening event, which changed them forever.
Well, it also makes me think of The Lord of the Rings and what happens to Gandalf. Gandalf has that battle with the Balrog, and it looks like he's died.
Darkness took me, and I strayed out of thought and time. The stars wheeled overhead, and every day was as long as a life age of the earth. But it was not the end. I felt life in me again.
I've been sent back.
We have to remember that Tolkien, who was a Catholic, was probably making a parallel with Christ, with the resurrection in that, because I mean Gandalf really does seem to die and is reborn again in this extraordinary way. He comes back to finish his work.
Gandalf?
Yes. That was what they used to call me. Gandalf the Grey. I am Gandalf the White, and I come back to you now at the turn of the tide.
Now, we've been talking about the wizard as the wise person, but there is another tradition, the dark magician.
It was dark times, Harry, dark times. Voldemort started to gather some followers, brought them over to the dark side. Anyone that stood up to him ended up dead.
I think this is a very ancient aspect of our own human nature. You know, there are those who would prefer to rule us rather than share our place in the universe. I mean, you've only got to look back to quite recent history, for instance, to the Second World War, when Adolf Hitler was absolutely fascinated by the occult and, in fact, had occult advisors, you know, so-called black magicians of the time, who said that they would help him to win the war. Fortunately, they weren't successful, and there are even stories that they were combated by white magicians from Britain and the United States. Not a side of the history that you hear very much.
There is no good and evil. There is only power, and those too weak to seek it. Together, we'll do extraordinary things.
You know, a lot of people find the whole idea of magic very threatening. It's been called satanic, and particularly certain Christian groups who, for instance, have tried to ban the Harry Potter books from their schools. Why has magic earned this other reputation that it is very threatening?
I think it comes out of fear, a fear of the unknown. And of course, it's very easy, particularly if you have very fundamental beliefs, to think or feel that, you know, that this is all there is to it. You've only got one kind of magic, and that's black and it's evil. But of course, anything that is unknown, anything that is unfamiliar, anything that has this much power associated with it will raise feelings of fear in some people. And when they're afraid, then they begin to hate.
Now, your interest in magic is, I know, more than just theoretical. I've read that you believe you've had encounters with Dr. John Dee, the court magician for Elizabeth I.
Oh, yes.
Can you tell me what that's like?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you have to remember that I've been doing this for a long time, and I hardly even think of it now as being extraordinary, but I do, you know, make visualative journeys, if you like, in which I'll have a scenario prepared beforehand. Let's just say for a moment that I'm sitting in my chair at home, and I'm visualizing going up a flight of stairs, opening a door, going into a room. And in the room is a fireplace and some bookcases and maybe some strange objects hanging from the ceiling or standing on the table. And sitting there is the great magician John Dee. And I feel that I'm sitting down in his presence. And I then feel that I can have a conversation with him. Now, you can say, if you like, I'm having a conversation with myself, with my subconscious. It doesn't really matter. What's so interesting is that when you do this, you get a real sense of being in the presence of this person. And I've been told things by him that I felt I did not know, that I did not understand. I've had things explained to me. And, you know, part of me, my rational mind, if you like, knows that I'm not sitting in that room and I'm not talking to John Dee. But there's another part of me that feels I'm accessing something that my ordinary everyday consciousness can't quite reach. And somehow I am contacting something more deep.
John Matthews has written more than 40 books on the Arthurian legends and the Western mystery tradition. His most recent is called Merlin, Shaman, Prophet, Magician.
I wish on the seven sisters bring to me wisdom of age. All that's locked within the book of secrets, I long for the knowledge of a sage. On the hills, the fires burned at midnight, superstition made the air sparks fly as the fires burn at midnight, stars are out and magic is here. The stars
don't go away. We've got more magic still to come, including a visit with two very gentlemanly wizards, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming, and we're talking this hour about magic, about how many people believe in it, practice it, what they get out of it. We're going to talk next with one of America's best-known witches, or Wiccans, Starhawk. She's an environmental activist and a political organizer, and the author of The Spiral Dance, a book that's considered a kind of Bible for the neo-pagan movement. Starhawk has a new book out called The Earth Path. She told Anne Strangechamps that if you were in San Francisco for Halloween, or Samhain, you could join the pagan community there for an evening of magic and music, like this.
This year may we renew the earth. This year may we renew the earth. Let it begin with each step we take, and let it begin with each change we make, and let it begin with each chain we break, and let it begin every time we awake.
Let it begin with the rains.
Samhain is a very important time of year in terms of the cycles of the seasons. It's really when you're closing off the cycles of growth and moving into the cycles of winter, of death and regeneration. And in the goddess tradition, we see everything in terms of cycles and relationships. So death is always followed by rebirth, but birth and growth always leads on to some form of death, decay, and regeneration. Mm-hmm. And it's very much linked to the way things actually work in nature. Anyone who grows a garden knows that you can only get fertility in the soil by something else dying and decaying. So we don't see death as something that's terrible or fearful. It's all part of the natural cycle of things. And Samhain, even though it's going into the dark in the winter, is also our new year because it represents the beginning of the new cycle as well as the end of the old cycle.
Mm. How do you tend to celebrate it?
Well, we have a big celebration coming up called the Spiral Dance. We usually have a big public ritual where we'll have maybe a couple thousand people dancing a spiral together. And this year, especially, we're working with the image of Hecate, who's the old Greek goddess of the crossroads, because we feel like our country, our nation, our world is at a crossroads. And we want to really ask for help to choose the right path, to choose a path that leads on to life and growth and regeneration and turn away from a path of fear.
So how will you work with that, the image of Hecate?
We'll sort of call her into the circle. We'll have someone sort of personify her, and we'll lead people into a meditation where we can each look at the crossroads we're facing in our own lives, look at the choices that we each make every day between fear and life, and ask, you know, and you could say pray for the strength to make the choices that lead on to balance and to harmony and peace.
How did you come to this particular path? I mean, the dust jacket on the back of your new book calls you America's favorite witch, but you weren't.
I'm having them take it off, the next one. Any real witch would look at that and say, well, I don't know, she's not my favorite witch.
It sort of harks back to Bewitched for some of us, a certain generation. You weren't raised Wiccan or pagan, were you?
No, I was raised Jewish and still feel very much identified with that in many ways. But when I was in college, I began searching for some kind of spirituality that would reflect my own real experiences, which were always in nature and always in connection with the earth. And when I heard that there was actually a religion, a spiritual tradition that said nature is sacred and that worshipped a goddess that saw that divine that really goes beyond any kind of form, but saw it in female images, I found that tremendously empowering for me as a young woman.
Why did a goddess-based spirituality matter to you? What does that change?
Well, I think when we talk about the goddess, we're talking about seeing all of these qualities that in a patriarchal society get assigned to women, qualities of nurturing, of relationship, of compassion, of sustaining life. We're saying these things are sacred. That means that they are also sources of strength. And in our culture today, those things tend to be put down as sources of weakness. If you look at our political debates, which we've had the opportunity to do recently, you know, what you see is men having to prove how strong they are by how aggressive they're willing to be and how much they're willing to kill. And anybody who says, hey, wait a minute, actually, relationships are a source of strength. Relationships are a source of security. you know, risk being portrayed as weak and cowardly and somehow womanlike, which is the worst thing you can be as a leader. And we're saying, no, that's wrong. You know, these qualities of nurturing, of compassion, of respect for life, these things are sacred, and these things are sources of strength.
You could say those things without necessarily wanting to image the divine as feminine.
Yes, and, you know, for many people, you know, there's no reason why they should. We don't proselytize or say everyone has to believe in the goddess. But for many people, the way our minds work as human beings, it's easier for us to really grasp something on a visceral level if we have an image for it.
You said your attraction to Wicca or paganism began with some experiences in nature. What sorts of things?
Well, for me, when I was out in nature, it was always the time that I felt most deeply connected to all of life. So, you know, mystical experiences in the goddess tradition aren't necessarily the heavens opening up and voices thundering. You know, they're really very common, ordinary things, like being out in the forest and just feeling the peace that you can feel in the presence of the redwoods or the ancient trees, or going to the beach and watching the waters lap on the shore, or watching birds and listening to birds and starting to come into some kind of real relationship with the life that's going on around us. And in fact, that's very much what my new book, The Earth Path, is about, is how we, in very simple, ordinary ways, can come into a real relationship with the natural world.
One of the things you write in the new book is that to be a witch, to practice magic, you have to do more than honor nature's cycles in the abstract. What did you mean by that?
I mean that if you're honoring nature's cycles, you actually have to do some very practical things in your life to try to come into balance with nature. You actually have to go out and touch real trees. You know, you want to put your hands in real dirt and not just sit in your living room and burn incense and think about some abstract concept of earth.
Well, so take this time of year, for instance. We're talking about Samhain and the idea of that this is the end of the old year, the end of the harvest cycle, and the beginning of a new season. How do you then make it more concrete?
Well, you know, for me, I'm a lucky person. I actually have land and fruit trees, which I prune. And this time of year, we had a tremendous burst of apples this year. So I've been madly picking them and canning them and making apple pies. You know, something as simple as that can be a real concrete way of connecting. And for me, that's not just something I do because I enjoy doing it, though I do, but for me it's also sort of a spiritual act of honoring the gift of abundance in those trees by actually taking the fruit, doing something, using it. You know, you're in Madison, I'm in California. For us, this really is the beginning of the new cycle because it's the time when the rains come and the land that's been very brown and dry starts to turn green again. I know in Madison, it's a different climate cycle, and you're probably not looking at going out and planting your new perennials. You're probably looking at putting your garden to bed and waiting for the snow to come. But it's also a time, you know, in many of those climates where it's a good time to turn inward and to focus on what you're harvesting in your own life and acknowledge those things that have gone well and also maybe do some internal composting of those things that have not gone so well. So you can kind of leave them behind, let them turn into something else, take the lessons you might have learned from them in order to begin planting something new.
And where does the magic come in?
All of that is magic. Magic is not really just, you know, waving a Harry Potter wand and making demons appear. It's really very, very simple things. My favorite definition for magic is the art of changing consciousness at will. It's not so much even anything you do, it's often how you think about what you do. So again, you can sit there and you can be canning fruit and saying, oh, I'm hot, I'm sweaty, I hate this. Or you can be canning fruit and saying, you know, I'm grateful, I'm blessed with this abundance, I'm so thankful, I'm so happy. And the shift in your attitude is going to make a big shift in not only what you get out of that activity, but also what other people get when they eat that fruit that you've canned.
Starhawk talking with Anne Strangechamps. She's an environmental activist, co-founder of one of the largest neo-pagan communities in the world, and a writer. Her most recent book is called The Earth Path.
Isis has started Iana, Hecate to me to call him Inanna. Isis has started Iana, Hecate to me to call him Inanna.
What do you get when you cross Harry Potter with Jane Austen, throw in a dash of Dickens, a few blasted heaths, and an ancient fairy king? You get an 800-page novel with footnotes that's being called Harry Potter for Grown-Ups. Actually, it's even better than that. Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, the new novel by Susanna Clarke, appeared this fall to rave reviews. Writer Neil Gaiman calls it the finest English novel of the fantastic written in the last 70 years. It's a story filled with old London streets and dark forests, with historical figures like the Duke of Wellington, and with the adventures of two gentlemen magicians. I asked Susanna Clarke why she wanted to write about magic.
Because I loved books about magic and magicians when I was a child. C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia were a big part of my childhood, and I think provided a lot of the images and the stories at that time of my life, that it sort of was a model for me of what a wonderful book could be and how it could take me over. But it didn't occur to me to write a book of fantasy until I tried writing several contemporary novels and failed utterly. I was in Bilbao in 1992 and I was trying to write a detective novel. And it was a very bad detective novel. It had no plot. So I gave it up, and at the same time I wasn't terribly well. So I was rereading The Lord of the Rings by Tolkien, and I was absolutely loving it. And when I finished, it just seemed obvious that that was what I should try to do next.
We should talk a little bit about your magicians, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. Who are they? What are they like? They're very different from each other, it seems to me.
Mr. Norrell is a middle-aged man, but he was kind of born middle-aged, and he has a large estate in Yorkshire and a huge library of books that he's acquired painstakingly over the years. And he is in some ways almost more library than man. He is almost the physical manifestation of a library. He is all about books.
He's a fussy, very self-important man, too.
And he's fussy and he's shy and he's a bit afraid of other people. He's much more comfortable alone in his library than he is out in the wider world. And he's very jealous of the knowledge that the books contain. He's not at all sure that he wants to share it with other people. And Jonathan Strange is almost the diametrical opposite. He's charming, he's arrogant, he finds it very easy to talk to people. When he learns something about magic, he's perfectly willing to share it with anybody whatsoever. And also, he loves adventure. He goes to the Peninsular War with Lord Wellington. He really enjoys being part of that world and socializing with the officers, who are all very young and dashing.
Now, these are not magicians in the way that we've come to expect magicians. This doesn't seem to come out of the English tradition of magicians. There's no Merlin here. These are gentlemen who have acquired the skill of magicians. You do have the man called the Raven King, who is really more a figure of myth of the kind of thing we'd expect from a book of magic, isn't he?
Yes, he's a human child originally who was stolen away to fairy, as fairies often do steal human children, and he's much more romantic and his powers are much stronger. And there's a sort of idea that in each period of England's history, the magic reflects the history, the culture of the time. So by the time you get to the Regency period, it's more about libraries and books and scholarship.
When your story begins, which is right in that period, magic has been gone from England for a very long time. Everybody remembers that there was magic, and there are some who call themselves magicians but wouldn't, under any circumstances, actually practice magic. How, in fact, does magic come back?
At that point, Mr. Norrell is determined to prove that he is quite unique among the magicians in England, that he is something quite different from the theoretical magician. So he is determined to make a big splash at this point. And the magicians who are present, who are witnesses, are really elated and astonished. And some of them are a bit dismayed, because some of them really didn't want to actually see magic. They only wanted to talk about it.
I wonder if you would read just a little bit from the scene in the Yorkshire Cathedral when magic does make its return.
I will gladly do so. As the sounds of the bells died away, a voice began to speak from somewhere high up in the gloomy shadows above their heads. The magicians strained their ears to hear it. It was an extraordinarily harsh, deep and rasping voice. It was like two rough stones being scraped together. And yet the sounds that were produced were clearly intended to be speech, indeed were speech. When translated into clear, comprehensible English, it was something like this. "Long, long ago," said the voice, 500 years ago or more, on a winter's day at twilight, a young man entered the church with a young girl with ivy leaves in her hair. There was no one else there but the stones. No one to see him strangle her but the stones. He let her fall dead upon the stones, and no one saw but the stones. He was never punished for his sin because there were no witnesses but the stones. The years went by, and whenever the man entered the church and stood among the congregation, the stones cried out that this was the man who had murdered the girl with the ivy leaves wound into her hair, but no one ever heard us. But it is not too late. We know where he is buried. In the corner of the south transept. Quick, quick, fetch picks, fetch shovels. Pull up the paving stones, dig up his bones, let them be smashed with the shovel, dash his skull against the pillars and break it. Let the stones have vengeance too. It is not too late, it is not too late. Mr. Thorpe, who was a valiant gentleman, peeped into the chancel alone to discover who it was that spoke. "It is a statue," he said. And then the gentlemen of the York Society peered up again into the gloom above their heads in the direction of the first unearthly voice, and this time very few of them had any doubts that it was the little stone figure that spoke, for, as they watched, they could perceive its stubby stone arms that it waved about in its distress. Then all the other statues and monuments in the cathedral began to speak, and to say in their stony voices all that they had seen in their stony lives, and the noise was, as Mr. Segundus later told Mrs. Pleasance, beyond description. For York Cathedral had many little carved people and strange animals that flapped their wings. Then all at once there seemed a change in the sound, and one by one the voices stopped until the magicians heard the bells of St. Michael the Belfry ring for the half hour again. The first voice, the voice of the little figure high up in the darkness, continued for some time after the others had fallen silent, upon its old theme of the undiscovered murderer. It is not too late, it is not too late, until it too fell silent. The world had changed while the magicians had been inside the church. Magic had returned to England, whether the magicians wished it to or not.
Is there a part of you that wishes we had magic? I mean, are we like those people who have been so removed from magic that we can't believe in it?
That's a very good question. I think that I wrote this book partly because I don't believe in magic. I wanted to write a book where people could escape into another world, as I'm so fond of doing when I read, and really be carried along by a story. But there's another aspect of the book, which is that I've tried to make most of the characters fairly sympathetic and also point out aspects of people's kindness to each other. And I think there's a lot of that in the book. I think sometimes that literature dwells too much on people being mean to each other and not enough on the more positive aspects. And I think that's the sort of magical thing that we have in the world.
Susanna Clarke's new novel is called Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. You've seen it in bookstores. It's the one that's even fatter than the last Harry Potter book. Next, can quantum physics explain magic? A new indie movie mixes hard science with new age philosophy and asks, what the bleep do we know? I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Mix quantum physics, theories of consciousness, a lot of glitzy computer graphics, and a woman channeling a 35,000-year-old spiritual warrior, and what do you get? A box office bonanza. The indie film What the Bleep Do We Know is packing art houses in cities across the country. A lot of viewers are going back two or even three times. What's the draw?
Why are we here? Well, that is the ultimate question, isn't it?
What is reality?
I think the more you look at quantum physics, the more mysterious and wondrous it becomes.
Have you ever thought about what thoughts are made of?
Asking yourself these deeper questions opens up new ways of being in the world. It brings in a breath of fresh air. It makes life more joyful. The real trick to life is not to be in the know, but be in the mystery.
The film is What the Bleep Do We Know? A heady mixture of quantum physics and New Age philosophy. We'll hear from its director in just a minute, but first, for every viewer who loves this film, there seems to be a scientist who hates it. Michael Shermer is the director of the Skeptic Society and a columnist for Scientific American.
What bothers us is the bad science. It's not a bad film in a sense. It's a beautifully produced film. It's artfully edited. The music is wonderful, and you know, it is a compelling film, but like Fahrenheit 9/11, you don't know which factoids that are being thrown at you you can trust and which you can't, and many of them you can't trust, because even though they're put forward by so-called real scientists, these are scientists that are really quite on the fringes of science, and if you're not in science, you wouldn't know that. So when they talk about these implications of quantum mechanics, they're speaking really as a tiny minority. Most physicists do not share those particular perspectives. And I will have to say that I was further put off by the use of a woman named Jay-Z Knight, who runs a New Age Enlightenment organization up in the state of Washington, who she claims she channels a 35,000-year-old spirit warrior. And this is one of the primary interviewees in the film, as if this woman, who knows nothing about physics, who claims to channel this 35,000-year-old warrior, has something important to say about quantum mechanics or consciousness, which is just absurd. So I was taken aback by that.
New Age propaganda or revolutionary science? Well, let's meet one of the directors of What the Bleep Do We Know? Mark Vicente is a Hollywood director and cinematographer. He's worked on a number of big-budget, mainstream pictures. And Strange Champs asked how he came to make this one.
You know, for a long time in my life, I wanted to express some of the ideas that are in this film. And at the time, of course, I was, you know, shooting Hollywood movies and sometimes shooting stuff that I just thought was absolutely horrible and pathetic. And so, you know, based just on frustration in about the year 2000, I realized, you know, this is it. I can't be making other people's stories about things I don't care about anymore. I have to make stories that I care about.
Now, as a filmmaker, it must have been quite a challenge to figure out how to get quantum physics, theories of consciousness, neural networks, and God into a movie an audience would actually sit through.
And we kept on saying to ourselves, the only way people will remain interested is if we hang the story on an emotional story about somebody that they might care about or identify with. So what we did is, you know, we got Marlee Matlin to get on board with the film, and we had her story about the depressed and shut down photographer who has all these breakthroughs in her life. And we realized if we could get people to care a little bit about her, we could then ride some of these ideas on a story and keep people emotionally engaged, because nobody wants to sit through an hour and a half lecture.
Well, you also had to make some of these ideas visual. So describe a little bit how you went about doing that. I mean, the scene with the little boy on the basketball court, for instance.
Welcome to Duke Reginald's Court of Unending Possibilities.
She, like Alice in Wonderland, walks onto this basketball court, into this court of, you know, infinite potentials, which is a wacky court, and which is the way the quantum field works. And there she meets the little boy, you know, Robert Bailey Jr., the actor, who has all these amazing abilities, and he's showing her how the quantum field works. And so, for instance, you know, he's saying to her that, you know, reality isn't fixed. It's this series of probabilities, of probable maybes, that only comes into existence when you as the observer look at it and collapse that reality into a single reality. And so, for example, on the basketball court, when she turns away from him, the basketball he's bouncing turns into multiple basketballs bouncing at different rates in different places. And the minute she turns around to look, it all collapses into one. And so his job is there is to be this little master who's teaching her about how reality actually works.
Being in many places at once, experiencing many possibilities all at once, and then collapsing on the one.
You really have to recognize that even the material world around us, the chairs, the tables, the rooms, the carpet, all of these are nothing but possible movements of consciousness. This is the only radical thinking that you need to do. But it is so radical, it's so difficult, because our tendency is that the world is already out there, independent of my experience.
You now can see in numerous labs around the United States objects that are large enough to be seen by the naked eye, and they are in two places simultaneously. And you can actually take a photograph of that. I don't think people really believe it. I don't mean that people say, oh, you're lying, or, oh, the scientists are confused. I think it is so mysterious that you can't even understand how amazing it is. There is this completely amazing magic sitting right in front of your eyes.
Now I want to ask you about some of the science. I'm not a scientist. You aren't either. But
I'm not, no.
Were you careful about what you would call mainstream, real, verifiable science and what would be pretty fringy?
You know, we have to ask, you know, what mainstream science is. There's so many anomalies that contradict, you know, what everybody says is true. I mean, at one point we thought that the world was flat. At one point we thought that the sun revolved around the earth. There's so many ideas that we once had that simply, you know, turned out not to be true. And we don't think that this film is truth necessarily. We think it's philosophy.
The other main criticism of the film has to do with the involvement of the person called Ramtha.
That is correct, yeah.
Did you intend the movie to introduce Ramtha's ideas to a wider audience?
No, I think we, you know, because first of all, I don't think the school is for everybody. I do attend the school, and I've just recently finished a retreat as of yesterday. I do not like the idea of recruiting because it has a sort of a zealous nature, you know, that I see in a lot of other organizations, you know, somehow that I know something that nobody else knows, and so I got to convince them to come to my school of thought, which I just don't think is the way it should be. So, no, it was just that we had a curiosity about this information, and we saw connections that we felt that most people weren't aware of because they're hidden in little weird bookstores and, you know, New Age stores and self-help sections in bookstores and in colleges and professors' minds. It never got out into the mainstream. And basically, if you look at the numbers and how well this film is doing, it suggests that there's an audience out there who is also fascinated in these ideas.
Have you been surprised by the kind of attention the film is getting? I mean, I've heard reports that people who see it are going back more than once. So they're taking friends and they're sitting in the dark with little notebooks writing things down.
Yeah, they are. It's pretty bizarre. I mean, I know that as of last week on the top 20, we were number 19 in the box office and our numbers were still positive, which is very unusual and
so
very strange.
What's the nerve that's been touched? I mean, who would have predicted that a film on quantum mechanics and neurology would take off this way?
I think the film gives people back hope because it makes them realize that perhaps they have choices they haven't exercised. And I think that people are so refreshed by these ideas rather than the kind of stuff that's out there right now. I mean, it's the same. The movies are all the same, every single time. Every teenage movie you see is about boy meets girl, misunderstanding, boy runs away, old girl runs away, they make up, they get together, this happens, that. It's the same every single time, and it touches the same emotional buttons. And I think that there's a group of people in the world that are getting very, very bored, and they're looking for more. And I think that group has looked at this film and said, you know what, some of these ideas make a lot of sense to us. And so it's such a breath of fresh air to them that the idea that, you know, perhaps reality is within their command.
If reality is my possibility, possibility of consciousness itself, then immediately comes the question of how can I change it? How can I make it better? How can I make it happier? And therefore, literally, I create my own reality. It may sound like a tremendous bombastic claim by some new agey without any understanding of physics whatsoever, but really quantum physics is telling us that.
You said the film, you think one of the big draws of the film for the audience is that it gives people back hope. And I was thinking, you know, that's what religion did originally. And I'm wondering whether you're trying to construct a science that people can believe in, a science that tells us some of the same things religion used to tell us.
I think that what we most want to do, because we're not trying to create a new religion, I think what we're most trying to do is have people be curious and ask questions that they haven't asked before. Not all religions are helpful to people. The idea that we're born as sinners, and I know this isn't some of the more what I call archaic religions, I don't think those ideas are helpful to people, that we were born sinners, that we have to somehow make up for something. The idea that there's this man with a long beard floating in a cloud with a laptop keeping score about the good and bad things we do, I don't think those ideas work. So I think the relationship between science and the study of God and religion is that it points to something so mysterious. You know, if we think about, just for a second, you know, in the film we say there's 400 billion bits of information being processed in the brain per second. We're aware of 2,000 of those. That we're using, you know, less than 10% of the possible connections in our brain. There is so much more that to say that we have arrived at a definition of who we are and a definition of what God thinks we should or shouldn't be is backward. There's got to be more. I mean, if science is just starting to understand some of these ideas and it's only at the precipice, the beginning of a world that's so weird and so astounding, we'd have to open our mind and say, gee, I wonder if there's more possible. And that's what we really want people to do, is say, I wonder if there's more.
Mark Vicente is one of the directors of the movie What the Bleep Do We Know? And Strange Champs talked with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. For more information about anything you heard in this hour, or for information about ordering tapes or CDs, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. You've been listening to The Magic Show.
PRI, Public Radio International.